From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer here at the Graduate School of Education at Stanford, and I am here with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is the dean of the Graduate School of Education. Today, we have a very exciting show. We have Mike Kirst, who has spent his life's work on education, and he will be talking to us about school finance. And we have a very exciting show today because...
Nostalgia.
This is officially our 50th show, 5-0.
It's pretty amazing.
Our show has hit middle age. we have both hit middle age a long time ago,
but our show is catching up.
Middle age, yes. It's exciting. Are you excited, Dan?
I am excited. So what 50 shows, doing radio is kind of tough. You have to think about what you're going to say next while you're listening intently. So what have you learned in 50 years?
What have I learned?
Or 50 years, yeah. Sorry, 50 shows.
It feels like 50 years sometimes, the 50 shows. No. I've learned how to do the whole thing a little bit better because people might not know this, but I'm the one who's more in charge of the timing.
You're in charge of everything.
I'm in charge of the whole show. No, yeah. We have wonderful producers and people behind the scenes who help us, but I've learned about how to Dan not to ask a question at the very last minute that's going to take 20 minutes when you have 30 seconds left.
So I've learned a lot, but one of the things that's been sort of funny on this show is that you and I are just the talent.
Yeah.
We don't have much control over like the format. And there's this opening clip of me on every show that goes something like, they believe that blah, 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 being told is everything. And I have no idea what I'm saying.
No.
And I've been trying to get this clip out of there for like 45 shows and I can't get rid of it.
I love it. I think nobody knows what you're saying in that clip.
I think we should have a
contest and people should call in and say what they think you're actually saying because nobody knows. I think that's very true. Do you have a show that sticks out in your head as particularly memorable?
I have themes that stick out.
Okay.
Theme. So I think the Denise can't do math theme.
Oh.
The problem is, it's just not true. You're very good at math.
Thank you, Dan, for telling everybody that. I'm really glad that you're letting folks know because you do like to make fun of me when it comes to the math. So.
I'm the straight man for you. But there was another thing that I sort of remember offenses or mistakes. And so I still don't know. There was a show a couple back where I said the Wikipedia.
Yes.
And everybody laughed. Yeah. So what is wrong with saying the Wikipedia?
You know.
Because I refer to you as the Denise.
Yes, I know. You refer to me in lots of different ways. That's another funky thing about the show is you always have a different name for me.
Yes.
People, I'm sure, have picked up on that. We'll see what you'll do today once we introduce our guest. But the Wikipedia is not what people say. It's like... when you talk about freeways in California, it's a tell if you're from Northern California or Southern California if you put the word the before it. So if you say, I'm going to take the 101, the Highway 101, versus I'm going to take Highway 101.
Wow.
The people in Southern California put the in. So you're from Southern California, so maybe we'll allow you to say the Wikipedia. Okay.
Well, let me tell you what I've really learned. I have learned that you are a wonderful person and a tremendous co-host.
Oh.
And an infinite source of knowledge and very careful about our timing.
And very bossy about our timing. Well, Dan, I will say this. It's been an absolute pleasure to do 50 shows with you, even on days when you and I are both thinking, what are we going to say next? I know I can look over at you and you come through with a great question or a brilliant question.
They believe that being told is everything.
And worst comes to worst, Dan can always spew a Jane Austen quote or talk about philosophy. He's a man of many, many talents. So it's been fun. It's been exciting.
Thank you, Denise.
Here's to 50 more. And we're really lucky today.
Yes, we are.
We not only is it our 50th show and it's a super celebration, we decided to get a superstar to be part of our 50th show. And as luck would have it, this particular person has been involved with education for almost 50 years. So I'm thrilled to introduce Michael Kirst. He has spent his life's work on education. He has had roles in government and academia. He's currently the president of the California State Board of Education. In that role, he's the chief education advisor to Governor Jerry Brown, who's the governor of the state of California. He has worked with Governor Brown in his most recent term, but he's also worked with Governor Brown over the years, including his first term in the 1970s. He's also worked with President Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s on Title I, as well as in positions in the Senate.
Wow.
He is amazing.
Wow.
He is retiring from his state appointment this year. This is a celebratory show. Lots of things to celebrate. And he still comes to work every day at Stanford. He blogs. His blog is called College Puzzle. It's fabulous. He writes books, and his most recent book is Higher Education and Silicon Valley, Connected but Conflicted.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mike Kirst, it is our honor to welcome you to our 50th show.
Well, thank you for having me. I've been at Stanford since 1969, so it's a pleasure to do this.
It's fabulous. And I have to say one thing. Mike was my very first education professor. When I was an undergrad, he was one of the few people actually teaching courses with undergrads in them.
Wow.
And Mike, you're one of the main reasons why I decided to become a teacher. So you have changed my life as well as the lives of many others, but I wanted to say an official thank you to you for that.
That was a great class to teach, Introduction to American Education Policy.
Exactly. And we read Who Controls the Schools, which is a great question to ponder.
Yeah, everybody and nobody is the answer.
So, Mike, for those of us out there in the world, why do we care about school financing? I'm going to take a sharp right turn here.
Okay. School financing, like any financing, provides the resources for educators and children to work together for them to learn. There, you know, is arguments about equity, how much, you know, just adequacy. Is there enough funding to support a really high-quality education? Some districts have that, some don't. There's arguments about whether the funding is equitable. Some school districts have lots of property, and they are able to have very high expenditures. And then there's an argument about efficiency. We spend in California $100 billion on education. And could this be spent efficiently, including more technology?
That's including higher ed, the $100 billion.
No, that's kindergarten through 12th grade only.
Wow.
That's a lot.
How about the feds? How much do they bring in?
They provide only 9%, about $9 billion. So they are very small, and they get a lot of press, but most of the action is, of course, in financing at the local and state level, which share the rest, 45% each.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Mike Kirst, Professor Emeritus of Education and Business Administration at Stanford University, about school financing, something that a lot of parents may have no idea. They know that their taxes go to schools. They have no idea how that is calculated, how that money is actually spent on their kids.
That's true, yeah. Historically, we're the only country that I know of in the world that finance schools from a local property tax. Everybody else started using it from a more central body like a state or most often a national system. But we've had over 100,000 districts in the beginning of the 20th century, and they all used mostly their local property tax, and the state and federal taxes were maybe 10 or 15% of the amount. So this led to huge inequities where some districts had a lot of wealthy property owners and commercial property, and then districts that just had a lot of poor farms, and they spent very little. So the U.S. is the most historically inequitable system I've known in terms of that, going back to the property tax. And nobody I know of has local school boards like we do. They were, of course, the people that helped raise the local property tax, decided on the property tax. So this is a very strange situation we've had here, and we've worked for years to provide more money and equity through state money primarily, and some a little through federal.
So is this just a historical accident, or is there an argument for why you'd want it to be locally funded?
I think local control. Yes, the argument for it is that if people know their money's being spent locally and raised locally, they're more willing often to tax themselves. Mm-hmm. In California, which restricts dramatically how much money you can raise locally, they really voters are reluctant to spend the money to Sacramento and somehow get it back through some arcane formula and process they don't understand.
Interesting. Interesting.
And you can actually see your money go to work. You see a building being built after you pass a bond. You see more technology in the school. So I think that that at least makes parents feel a little bit better that they see it in action, but it does promote sort of this problem with equity.
Yeah, there's a second order problem that the golden rule, he who has the gold sets the rules.
Yeah.
So as you move the taxes up the system to state and federal, you centralize control, and the state governments say, well, we're paying for half or majority of this funding, and we want to set all these restrictions on the local districts. And all these restrictions build up and build up and build up, and we got to a point in California where you had a special state grant for to build a school garden, but you couldn't keep the bathrooms clean because that was needed unrestricted money.
So you did something about this. You did something about that crazy system in California. I once had a school superintendent say to me, I am not using this money, and I tried to give it back. I do not need this money, which is a rare thing for a superintendent to say. And literally the state of California is not allowing me to give it back. And I remember thinking, that is crazy. But this is why we have Mike Kirst, and he did something pretty major in California. You change the rules so that that kind of stuff isn't happening anymore.
Well, I'm regarded as, quote, the father of the school finance reform here, but the people that really pulled it off are the legislature and the governor, and primarily the governor, who had been the mayor of Oakland, saw this situation very close and said, we just need to throw the whole system out. So we did redesign the system, and we repealed large numbers of the restrictions and the categorical programs for everything from remedial reading teachers to school gardens. And then we equalized the funding more by having a formula that adjusted for the number of low-income students in your district. And if you have a concentration of over 55% in your school district of these low-income students, then you get 50% more. And so 20% if you're if you don't have a lot of students. So we had a theory of concentrated poverty, and if you have a concentration, you get even more for these pupils. So, and we were able to increase funding dramatically over the last 5 years. So that's fueled by the growth in the California economy. We just got lucky and put this in, and when the time the economy came roaring out of the 2008 recession in 2013.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are speaking with Mike Kirst, Professor Emeritus of Education here at Stanford University, and we are talking about school finance, something that people don't really think about. They know that they spend a lot of money. They know that they want to buy houses in good neighborhoods because they think that goes along with good schools. But Mike is actually, as he said, the father who helped to make some changes, particularly in California around this. Really exciting.
So when the state lifts the restrictions on how the money gets spent, does the state have any accountability system where it can sort of say, well, we do want you to spend this money well, even if we're not going to tell you exactly how to spend it?
Right. It does. And I think what's important to preface this is Governor Brown and I had these jobs when we were both 35, and then we both got into our 70s. And we decided we just aren't so smart now. We used to think we could solve all the problems when we were 35. We don't know enough in Sacramento to direct how they ought to spend their money. So we shifted the accountability from how you spend your money and hows into what results you're getting. And so it was, don't tell them how, just hold responsible for what happens. And so we have then produced a school dashboard, which is not just test scores, which has about five to seven elements and statewide and more that the locals can add. And so we have a robust accountability system, which does include assessment or test scores, but includes graduation rates, chronic absence, English learner progress, suspensions, school climate. So it's a very robust thing. So that's another big innovation in expanding people's vision about what it takes to make a good school. Parents don't send kids to school just because the tests are high. They're looking for many other things. And so, and then we have accountability where we give them colors. And if you are all in the red on those indicators, then the state will set up a system of support.
I don't think you understand how major of a change this is. This is a huge, huge, huge change. So cool that you got to work with the governor then, and with age comes wisdom, that you could say, okay, this is really what we need to do. And I think it probably wouldn't have happened. Well, I know it wouldn't have happened without you, and I think that your partnership with the governor coming back full circle really allowed it to happen, that level of trust, and it's just really exciting to see.
No, it's impressive policymaking.
And I think a lot of people get very cynical about policymaking, and a lot of people get very cynical about what individuals can do. And I think this is a really great story especially for our 50th show, right? You can make a difference. You can be an individual or a series of individuals. And as Mike said, obviously it took the legislator and a lot of support. But to study this your whole life and then to be able to make a difference in that way is just a huge cap on your career.
Yeah, I would add with a Stanford note that I was recruited here in 1969 from Washington, D.C., where I work for the U.S. Senate, to provide some faculty who knew about federal and state aid and federal and state policy, and particularly state finance. So that was they had a hole there. They really hadn't developed enough federal policy to even think about that until Johnson came in the mid-60s. So all of this has been something I've taught and worked on with students and many years as a professor.
Well, this is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We have been talking with Mike Kirst, a professor emeritus here at Stanford University in the School of Education, talking about school finance. We will have more with Mike and his illustrious career next on SiriusXM Insight 121. We translate the research we know about best practices with school, curriculum, and parenting to teachers, administrators, parents, and youth.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking today with Mike Kirst, who has spent his life's work in education. He is Professor Emeritus here at Stanford University School of Education and an expert on so many different things.
Because you know everything. and you've spent your life committed to public policy, public service. How can we get more people interested in a career of public service or in the government and public policy? Do you have thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think they have to, in part, understand how policy is made and where their role is in improving policy. There's a cycle of public policy or stages, and the latter stages are politicians negotiating a bill. Metternich said there's two things you never want to see made, and that's sausage and the laws of this state. And so that's the ending policy. Academics have little going on there. It's in the front end of it that you can have a big impact, and people should understand this. First of all, the front end is we have a problem, and making people aware of the problem. I don't have a detailed solution, but this is a problem you're not looking at. And secondly, you can begin to change people's assumptions about how to solve the problem. Basically, you need to go this general direction rather than another. And then lastly, you can work on crafting specific alternatives or an alternative that public policymakers can work on. And then on the back end of the cycle, you can spend time evaluating what has really happened. I mean, despite all the laudatory stuff in the first part of the of the show. People have raised questions through evaluations whether the money that we are allocating from the state to the local school districts is really getting to low-income children or being diverted into some other process. So the evaluation. So I think once people sense that it's not just all what they read in the paper and that you really can do this in that regard, I think that will make it more important. And
so do you need to be fearless? Is that or you just need to be extremely analytic?
You both.
And doggedly persistent.
Yeah. And you need to be like this radio show. You need to reduce things down to where politicians can understand it. Yeah. When I used to go in, they'd say, do you have a one-pager? Yes, here's my one-pager. and so reduction of data and complexity is also very important.
Right. And translating it, I think, for the masses, I think a lot of people you know, would get bogged down if you showed them the formulas, the complex formulas. But Mike is really good at translating complex things so that a lot of people can understand it. His books are not just academic, which is really cool. So,
well, is there a course on how to do that? I could really use it. My average paper is like 80 pages long and just tedious.
People don't read 80 pages. They just don't.
You know, my mom doesn't even read them.
Oh,
I know. She looked at it. She looked at one. This is such a tangent, but she looked at one of my papers and she said, "Oh, now I remember why I didn't like psychology."
Oh, nice, nice, really nice. Oh my goodness! So, if you're looking to get people excited about public policy and encourage more people to do the work that you do, are there certain areas that you think are kind of hot right now that people should go into? Like, if you were going to start your career all over again, would you go finance again? Would you? And you've done more than finance. Where would you go? Where are those pain points?
Yes, I would say that there's best opportunities are often at the local level. We have over 11,000 school districts, so working locally. The states vary, and there's a lot of focus on the national level. So as you see what's bubbling up from the local level, you see a lot of concern about social-emotional learning, which we haven't really figured out how to measure or deal with in policy. So this is an example of you've got a problem. These kids, not just that kids are poor or being bullied or under great stress, as you have written, Denise. And it's not just low-income people. Our suicide rates are really high in the United States. And so how does social-emotional learning tie in with teaching and understanding that? And how can we ask these local teachers to do, I'm going to deal with your social-emotional problems, and I'm also going to teach you mathematics.
Right.
So the problem is up there, and it's a good example of my problem discovery thing, but we haven't really come to a strong understanding or assumption or questioning our assumptions about how does policy get framed to address this social-emotional learning. I'm totally at sea on this. I know it's important, but I don't know what to do. You can have more grit than I do. We can maybe measure that somehow. I'm not sure about that. But in accountability, we're supposed to measure every 2 years whether your grit is growing faster than mine. I don't have the slightest idea how to do that. Neither do the psychologists, I don't think. So there's an emerging area.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are so lucky today to be speaking with Mike Kirst, talking about his long career in education and his work with policy and policy changes at schools.
So I have to ask, so you don't just work K-12, you work the whole system. So should community college be free? And if the answer is yes, should it be mandatory?
Right. In 1997, I began to get very interested in higher education. My answer to the question of whether community colleges should be free is a resounding no. The reason it shouldn't be free is that I do not think the state should spend its scarce money subsidizing wealthy people to go to community college. Mm. California you know, as, for example, has what's called fee waivers. Mm-hmm. And it's very goes pretty far up the income scale, not just low income. And if you can show that income is low, you get a fee waiver. But if you're making a lot of money, and a lot of adults go to community colleges, I don't see why I should spend money in giving money to children in Beverly Hills to go free to community college.
Yeah, but you won't bring that argument down to 10th, 11th, 12th grade where
– Right. I do think we have a we have compulsory education. And
right.
as long
right.
as you're compelling people to go, then it's hard to charge them.
Yeah. That's going to be a problem.
isn't that what the water – Water and power does?
You must drink water and
pretty much.
And therefore, and we are charging you yeah. to do it. That's interesting, Dan.
But do you think it should be compulsory? Given that the skills you need going forward or just maybe you can't cover them, K-12.
Well, one of the things we found in the book, Higher Education in Silicon Valley, is the seven-county San Francisco Bay Area has 350 institutions, only 32 of which are public. The rest are nonprofit and a very large for-profit sector. Mm. Now, when you bring up community colleges, as I stressed, you bring up adult education.
Right.
You bring up career and technical education. You bring up boot camps that people might want. You need a license to be a real estate broker. You can get that now, of course, on the web. There's a lot. There's specialty programs. My wife got a real estate license over McDonald's in Menlo Park, and that was her most important credential, despite Smith College. So,
yeah.
You know, it's higher ed is way too diverse, and the needs are way too diverse to make anything compulsory there.
Mike, thank you so much for being a part of our celebration. And thank everyone for listening to Schools In, all of these 50 shows with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Woo,
if you,
woo,
yeah, celebration, woo. Blow the horns, woo! If you missed any of this episode or any of our other shows, you can listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app on iTunes and on SoundCloud.